If you take out a short-term, high-interest loan, can you afford to pay it back? That's the question that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau said lenders must be able to determine under an Obama-era payday loan regulation. That rule was set to go into effect this August, but earlier this month, the CFPB proposed abandoning it. And that would mean consumers could be on the hook for loans they can't afford. Advocates have criticized the payday lending rollback, and Senator Elizabeth Warren released a statement saying the change gives the payday lending industry free rein to squeeze consumers and catch them in cycles of debt. It's part of the Trump administration's latest effort to deregulate the agency, which was born out of the ashes of the financial crisis back in 2011.
We cut the bureaucracy and put one consumer watchdog in charge with just one job, looking out for regular people in the financial system. And this is an idea that I got from Elizabeth Warren.
That was President Obama announcing Richard Cordray as the CFPB's first director. And here's Cordray on his first day on the job back in January of 2012.
Hidden fees and exploding interest rates have infected more products and services. Novel and exotic mortgages battered housing markets and triggered the financial crisis that wrecked the economy and hurt millions of people. With the stakes so high, consumers need better information about the costs and risks of borrowing.
Now in its eighth year, the CFPB is under new leadership with Director Kathy Kraninger, who previously served in the Trump administration's Office of Management and Budget. She's faced a lot of opposition from Democrats for what they say is a lack of experience.
Have you ever worked at a bank or a credit union?
Senator, I have not.
Have you ever had oversight or regulated a bank or a credit union?
No, Senator, I have not.
And have you ever been responsible for oversight or leadership in supervising payday lenders?
No, Senator, I have not.
Kraninger being grilled by former Senator Heidi Heitkamp at her confirmation hearing. I'm Tanzina Vega, and talking about protecting your money is where we start the conversation, here on The Takeaway. Jesse Eisinger is a senior reporter and editor at ProPublica, and he's been covering the evolution of the CFPB under the Trump administration, and he joins me now in studio. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined by someone with firsthand experience at the agency. Christopher Peterson is a former special advisor to the director at the CFPB from 2012 to 2016, and he's currently a law professor at the University of Utah. Thanks for being with us, Christopher.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Jesse, we just talked at the top of the segment that this payday lending rollback rule hasn't gone into effect yet, but give us a little bit of the backstory behind this rule.
Sure. Well, payday lenders are a particularly exploitative industry. They prey on desperate people who need small loans, and they charge extremely high interest rates in the 300 to 600% annually. The other thing about them that you really have to understand is that the industry says, we are the kind of people who tide people over. You're going to get paid on Friday. You need a couple hundred bucks on Wednesday. We tide people over and give them a short-term loan. That's not really the way the industry works, and it's not really the way they make money. What they do is they get people who can't actually pay that loan back on Friday. They're not coming in with a paycheck that they have money to spare with. And so they roll those loans over and they take out 6, 8, 10 loans a year. The interest rate really climbs and becomes a debt trap.
And a lot of the folks that are taking these loans out are people who are living paycheck to paycheck, like you said, or sort of trying to fill that short-term gap. So these aren't folks that have a lot of wealth or a lot of ability to pay these loans back, right?
No, I mean, that's actually most Americans don't have 400 bucks to tide them over in an emergency. These are particularly people in tough straits who might not have steady paychecks, might not have steady work hours. This is the kind of thing that, lives in an America that most, WNYC or ProPublica listeners and readers don't really see, but it's millions and millions of people in, storefronts on strip malls around the United States.
Chris, you joined the CFPB in 2012, and I'm wondering, we're starting the show here talking about this bureau that I think a lot of Americans will go, oh, God, Consumer Financial Protection, what is this? Eyes rolling in the back of head, Chris. But what was the goal of this bureau? Tell us, wasn't this meant to protect us, average everyday Americans?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you have to transport yourself back to the financial crisis and the aftermath of all of these unaffordable mortgage loans being made across America, millions and millions of families being expelled from their homes. One of the largest, if not the largest, forced migration of Americans in our history. The simple fact is that these financial products have a profound impact on the daily lives of people. And when they don't work out well, they can have such serious consequences for families, disrupting the ability of children to get an education, go to school, disrupting the ability of people to have shelter or access to transportation. It's absolutely critical in a modern society that we have some reasonable rules and limitations on the ability of financial institutions and other kinds of businesses, including payday lenders, to take advantage of people or engage in hidden tricks or traps or deceptive fees. That's absolutely crucial to whether or not we're going to succeed as a country.
And I'm wondering also if you can tell us a little bit, Chris, about the different types of rules or approaches that you all took to try and help consumers. The payday lending, essentially, you're saying payday lenders have to make sure that the person getting the loan can pay for it. If that rule is not implemented, what happens then?
Well, sure. I mean, first off, taking a step back, I mean, the CFPB, the first thing that it did is started enforcing the law. While I was there, the team of attorneys that were assembled by Director Cordray managed to return about $12 billion in consumer refunds and restitution to consumers. And the overwhelming majority of those cases came where the bank or financial institution or payday lender or other financial business said something that was untrue to their borrowers. They were misleading and deceiving their customers. And so that was the first thing, is to start trying to create some honesty and integrity in the marketplace. With respect to payday loans, it became clear after years and years of study that these financial products were not being used by customers that could actually afford to repay the debts, and they were rolling over their loans again and again. And that's a problem for people. Being exposed to 400, 500, 600% interest rates over a long period of time is destructive to a family's ability to save for retirement, to make payments on their rent or their car payments. And so it made sense that we needed some sort of regulation that would guarantee that payday lenders would determine whether or not borrowers had a reasonable ability to repay their debts without defaulting on all their other existing obligations and still having enough money left over at the end of the day to meet their basic family needs.
Jesse, let's talk a little bit about the Trump administration's approach to this bureau. We just heard at the top of the segment the Senate confirmation hearing for Kathy Craninger, who's now the permanent head of the CFPB, has not had a lot of experience with financial products, personal finance. What is the administration's goal with this bureau?
Well, I mean, to take a step back just a little bit, the Trump administration overall has led a very efficient effort to roll back regulations at the EPA, at the FDA, at the Interior, a wide variety of regulatory agencies. And so you see this kind of White House in a shambles, chaos with weak president. But beneath the surface, at the administrative level, it's highly efficient. And the CFPB probably is the best example of that. So Trump installed Mick Mulvaney, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, as his first director. Cordray was a holdover for a little while. He got out, and Mulvaney was highly efficient at rolling back a number of the CFPB's initiatives and then shutting down essentially their enforcement efforts. He left, and Kathy Craninger came in from OMB, and she's an apparatchik. She's a non-entity, and in fact, such a non-entity that they couldn't really muster any opposition to her among Democrats, aside from, a few tough questions, because no one knew anything about her. And she was kind of kindler and gentler face. Mulvaney was like a troll, basically. He did a lot of things to purposely poke the eye of the CFPB and provoke liberal tears. And Craninger has come in, and she's a much more sort of soft-spoken person. She rolled back some of the superficial things that Mulvaney had done, like change the name of the agency from the CFPB to the BCFP.
And what's the BCFP? What does that mean?
That was literally in the statute, the Dodd-Frank overhaul. It called for a Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. And so Mulvaney said, well, I believe in the literal letter of the law.
Okay.
And so we need to change the rule, which was going to actually cost banks millions and millions of dollars to change the letterhead and their computer programs. It was a completely meaningless and useless change, but he did meaningful changes too. She rolled that back very wisely.
I'm wondering, Chris, if you can tell us, where are Americans right now financially? We keep hearing from this administration in part that the economy is doing really well, unemployment is down, but are American consumers really in the clear, Chris?
Well, it's much more complicated than that. I mean, it is the case that the unemployment numbers are down and that the stock market has been bouncing around but is overall probably doing reasonably well. But behind that, there is a much more problematic story. So, for example, just last week, the New York Federal Reserve Bank issued some new numbers that, you know, people like me follow pretty closely, and it had some horrifying information. There are now 7 million Americans that are more than 90 days late on a car loan. That's about the time when they're going to be facing, you know, having their car repossessed by the bank or credit union or securitization trust that is the owner of that debt. That is happening right now, today. Those families are still in crisis. So is the economy doing that well? Well, it depends on who you ask. Billionaires are doing well. Millionaires are doing pretty well. But there are millions of American families that are on the precipice of losing access to transportation because their basic financial products are not working for them.
You mentioned the billionaires out of the world right now, and I think we're surrounded a lot. We're hearing a lot about a lot of money in our politics and a lot of money in our potentially in our presidential race. And I'm just thinking this CFPB was really meant to protect average consumers, not the billionaires. And it worries me that some of these regulations are being rolled back. Is there any hope for non-billionaire Americans who need these protections?
I sure hope so. I mean, one silver lining is that this Consumer Protection Agency, it still exists. And there's still, you know, over 1,000 employees that are there trying to do their best for the American public. Right now, my sense is that the political leadership of the agency is in a very serious way standing as an obstacle to the agency doing its job, but they are still bringing law enforcement cases from time to time, and they're still conducting examinations of banks and other financial institutions around the country. So I do think there's still the potential for this to be an effective agency, but it simply is the case that the number of law enforcement cases, the penalties and restitution that are coming out of those enforcement cases has declined. And this rollback of the rule on payday lending is a very troubling signal about whether or not the agency is going to take its consumer protection mission seriously in the coming years.
Jesse Eisinger is a senior reporter and editor at ProPublica, and Christopher Peterson served as a special advisor at the CFPB from 2012 to 2016 and is a current law professor at the University of Utah. Thanks to you both.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for having us.
There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
Colin Kaepernick hasn't played an NFL game in more than 2 years. In October 2017, he filed a grievance against the league's owners, alleging that they colluded to keep him off the field. The quarterback's lawyers called the owners' decision not to sign him, quote, retribution for Kaepernick's on-field protests against racial inequality. And now, Kaepernick and the league have agreed to put an end to the grievance through a confidential settlement. Speaking on Sunday at CNN, Kaepernick's lawyer Mark Garagos said he expects his client will eventually get signed.
I'm going to make a bold prediction, although I've been wrong once before on this. I'm going to make a bold prediction that one of three teams picks him up.
Whether or not Kaepernick has thrown his last pass into the pros, the settlement seems like a pretty good deal for him. At the very least, it's a concession by the NFL that they didn't want this case to go to trial. But it also means the public may never really know if anything was going on behind the scenes to keep him out of the league. And there's nobody better to talk with us about this than Jamel Hill, staff writer for The Atlantic. Jamel, thanks so much for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So what do we know? We don't know a lot about the settlement here, but what can we infer from this?
Well, I think you can definitely infer that the NFL was afraid for this to go to trial because, you know, there would have been a lot of things in the discovery process that would have been allowed. And there were reports that Colin Kaepernick's camp had text messages, emails, sensitive items that the league would never have wanted the public to see. And just in general, they're very wary about allowing not just the public, but in particular, the NFL Players Association, any kind of indication about how conversations about players and the inner workings of the league take place. Now, people have to remember that they settled the concussion lawsuit before that could fully go to trial. And this was part of the reason why, is that they didn't want any of the information, emails, phone or text messages, anything, memos to come out that would have given people an idea, I think, frankly, about how cold-blooded this billion-dollar industry can be. So you can not only just infer that there was a fear on the NFL's part, but you also can infer that this is the closest to an admission of guilt that Colin Kaepernick will probably ever receive, or those who support him. This is the closest thing you'll get to that.
We also talked, we know that Eric Reed, who was Kaepernick's former teammate on the San Francisco 49ers, also signed a settlement with the NFL over a grievance that he filed with the NFL last year. Now, unlike Kaepernick, Reed did end up getting signed by a team for 2018. What was Reed's role in all of this?
Well, Reed was a former teammate of Collins. He's a very close friend. And he joined him in this protest. And so, much like Colin, he received a lot of backlash. He also does a tremendous amount of charity work on the side. And one of the things that became public that he discussed is how in his charity events, you have businesses that were pulling out because of the protests he decided to engage in with Colin. So it not only cost him from a league earnings standpoint, because we have to remember there was a period of time where he was also unsigned, even though he eventually did get signed. And some of the same excuses that people would use with Colin Kaepernick, talking about how his last few seasons weren't as successful as, you know, maybe during the teeth of his career where he became a big star. Eric Reed was a Pro Bowl safety. And so his recent output certainly warranted a player his caliber should have been picked up right away, should never have been a free agent very long, but it extended. And I think it got to a point where necessity took over, and there was probably more of a clean avenue for him to come back to the league, because in the NFL, there's a different standard for quarterbacks as it is for someone who plays Eric Reed's position. Quarterbacks are considered the leader and the faces of a team. They're out there so much more. And so I think the expectation from a public relations standpoint is much different for Colin Kaepernick than it is for Eric Reed, which is why his signing eventually took place. But nevertheless, leading up to that, make no mistake, there were lost wages and lost amount of income that Eric Reed could certainly claim.
Also, I'm wondering what this means for the settlement, means for the future of activism within the NFL. I mean, I'm especially interested to know what it means for players who aren't quarterbacks, who don't make the type of money that a quarterback like Kaepernick would have made, who aren't as visible as Colin. Is there a sense that this settlement implicitly or indirectly tells players it's okay to be political, or could there be a chilling effect?
I actually worry about the opposite effect. I do worry about it more being a chilling effect, because you have to look at what Colin Kaepernick has sacrificed up until now. Even though his attorney has discussed the fact that he believes it's a possibility that a team will sign him, I personally do not carry that belief, that it still cost him 2 years of his career, and it may cost him his entire career. There's a lot of scrutiny, a lot of backlash, a lot of negativity that Colin Kaepernick faced. And lucky for him, before his NFL career kind of came to a halt, he was on a really big contract that I'm sure was able to kind of wade him through as he went through this process. As you mentioned, a player with lesser means may not have that ability to do that. And also understand that part of the reason why I think the NFL also settled is that they didn't want this. They didn't want there to be potential that a loss would be entered into public record, meaning that this would have become a precedent case. And that if another player did decide to protest or to do something the equivalent of what Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed did, they could point to this case as precedent that the NFL is capable of colluding against players who speak out. So legally, there's no precedent that exists. So a player that decides that they want to bring awareness to issues that matter with them will still probably face the same amount of backlash. And I'm not sure if a lot of these players, many of whom are not on guaranteed contracts, in fact, the majority are not, since that's just not the way the league generally does business. I'm not sure if this case, even this settlement, is going to inspire them to follow in his footsteps.
Jamel Hill is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Thank you so much, Jamel.
Thank you.
Have you ever been discriminated against because of your hair?
I am biracial, so anytime I would wear my hair down at work, people would tell me how wild it was. In 1994, I was told my goddess braids with extensions made my coworkers feel uncomfortable. The stylist physically balked when they saw her hair and told her that it would be better for her to have her hair cut by someone that understood it.
Well, on Monday, New York City's Commission on Human Rights released new guidelines that protect New Yorkers from being discriminated against because of the way they wear their hair at work, at school, and in public. The new law considers hair discrimination to be a form of racial discrimination and allows New Yorkers to sue if they're targeted. And while the law applies to anyone, it's specifically designed to address instances where black hairstyles, from dreadlocks to afros to braids, have prompted sometimes subtle and other times very overt examples of racism and discrimination. It's also the first guideline of its kind in the country. Rhea Tabaco-Marr is with me, and she's a senior staff attorney at the ACLU, and you're going to help us understand what this is all about. Rhea, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm listening to some of our callers, and we'll hear some of them in a little bit. When they're talking about wild hair and it being considered inappropriate, I get that. I feel that. What about you?
Well, one of the most pernicious stereotypes about natural black hair is this idea that it's inherently unkempt, it's messy, it's unprofessional. And those are exactly the stereotypes this new guidance is intended to combat. After all, this is the first time we've had official recognition that discrimination because of natural black hair is actually a form of discrimination against black people. That might sound like common sense, but actually courts have tied themselves up in knots trying to make a distinction between those two things. And this guidance really gives us a roadmap to understanding how discrimination based on hair is a form of discrimination based on race.
So you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last summer after a video came out showing a tearful elementary school student in Louisiana who was sent home for wearing braids. And that, of course, was not the first time we saw a young black girl or black child being disciplined because of their hairstyle. Tell us a little bit about your story and where this issue of hair discrimination comes from in this country.
Well, Tanzina, it's absolutely outrageous to think of children being taken out of school, missing class, barred from extracurriculars, suspended from school simply because of the way they wear their hair. And we've seen these incidents come up more and more now with the popularity of phone cameras. We're seeing viral videos of students as young as 6 years old being banned from school because of their locks, student athletes being banned from competition because of their hair. And this problem really is inextricably linked with our nation's history of anti-black racism and chattel slavery. You know, even the phrase dreadlocks is said to come from slave traders who viewed African hair as dreadful. So it's really impossible to disentangle those two forms of discrimination.
I keep thinking back to the more recent example of the wrestler in New Jersey who had his hair cut in that moment. That to me just felt really, I felt that deeply and intensely. What does that tell us about where we are today with this issue?
Well, it's shocking that in 2019, this is the first time we're having official recognition that discrimination against natural black hair is a form of race discrimination. And we see this come up not just in school, but also at work, as you mentioned earlier. Just a few years ago, there was a case of a woman named Chastity Jones who was hired for a customer support position. And when she was offered the job, she was told she could have the position on one condition, that she cut off her dreadlocks. And when she refused, she actually had the job offer rescinded. That, of course, is a very drastic consequence for any of us. And the manager admitted that the reason for the policy was the idea that locks tend to get messy, even though Ms. Jones's hair, in fact, was not messy. And so that's exactly the kind of group-based stereotype that laws against discrimination are supposed to protect us from.
So let's talk a little bit about the specifics of hair. And there are different textures and there are different colors. And there's a sentiment, I think, when we talk about hair in the workplace in particular, is that there's sort of this issue of appearing too ethnic, not white enough, not pressed enough, if you will. I mean, I recall, I don't have kinky hair in particular, but I have a ton of it, and it's very thick, and it's a lot, and I always felt I had to straighten it, even today, in order to appear professional. What, tell us a little, let's talk a little bit about that, the pressures that women, particularly women with textured hair, black hair, face when they walk into a workplace and have to feel, quote unquote, professional, and how that professionalism often means a certain standard.
Absolutely. Well, I think when it comes to what it means to look professional, sometimes those comments go unsaid and sometimes they're made quite explicit. So in the op-ed you mentioned, I shared a story in my own life. I do wear my hair in locks. And when I was in law school, I was dressed for an interview wearing a suit and told by a classmate, you know, nice suit, but you'll never look really professional with your hair in dreadlocks. And that comment really stuck with me. It was over 10 years ago. But I always felt that she had voiced something that other people were thinking but were afraid to tell me to my face. The idea that somehow wearing natural hair meant that I didn't look professional. And of course, that begs the question, what does it mean to look professional? And are we assuming a standard that is white, a standard that involves straight hair, and for those of us who have naturally kinky hair, means subjecting ourselves to costly, expensive, damaging chemicals in order to conform to that appearance at work?
I want to play some calls that we got. We heard a little bit of a sample of them from the beginning, but let's take a listen to a call from Cece.
This is Cece from Morgantown, West Virginia. I've experienced discrimination about my hair at work. In 1994, I was told my goddess braids with extensions made my coworkers feel uncomfortable. I heard the same feedback in 2000. After I got a short natural haircut, I still get the same message today, but continue to wear my short natural proudly ever since.
What is the problem that Cece's experiencing? I'm trying to envision the problem here. I don't see it. What is the issue?
Well, again, it shows us that race discrimination because of hair is far from a thing from the past. And when it comes to Cece's first example involving extensions, that's something we see time and time again. Rules against certain kinds of hairstyles that are facially neutral, but that are applied in an unfair way to punish black people. So, for example, girls in Massachusetts sent home from school for wearing box braids, including extensions, even though the yearbook at that same school included photographs of white students wearing hair extensions and other styles.
I was just going to say, I think of the Kardashians with cornrows, and I think is that, you know, like, I mean, where does the line sort of, you know, end? Let's listen to another call, because this also happens to black women in the military, black women in other professions. Let's listen to Sharon.
My name is Sharon, and I'm calling from Virginia because I'm a black woman in the military. For over 20 years, I've had to be concerned if my hair would be a discriminator on promotion boards. So I wear my hair naturally now, but when I take my official photo for the military, I wear a wig, so I'm not viewed as an outlier.
We've got about a minute left. I'm wondering, what kind of pressure does this put on women? And now, or women and men, now we have some recourse, right?
Absolutely. And it's important to point out that even though New York City is the first to state expressly that hair discrimination is a form of race discrimination, any place that bans race discrimination should bar this kind of discrimination as well. And I really want to encourage people to come forward and tell their stories. Only in the last few years that even the Army and the Marine Corps have lifted their ban.
And allowing women to wear twists and different types of hairstyles that they weren't allowed to wear before.
Absolutely. If the Army can do it, so can the rest of us.
New York City just released new guidelines on discriminations against hairstyle. Rhea Tabak-Omar joined me to talk about them. She's a staff attorney at the ACLU. Thanks so much, Rhea.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for talking with us. We'll be out on the West Coast tomorrow and Thursday, broadcasting live from KPCC in Los Angeles, and we're looking forward to seeing you in LA. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Back with you tomorrow.